Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the ballerina, writer and broadcaster Deborah Bull. The Royal Ballet, where she was a principal dancer for almost two decades, owes a debt of gratitude to the Janice Sutton School of Dance in Skegness. It was there, aged seven, two floors above a fish and chip shop and a row of amusement arcades, and having practiced good toes, bad toes, that she discovered precisely what she wanted to do with her life. After many years of success at the top of her profession, she said goodbye to her childhood dream and jetted into her life's next act, for a time serving as creative director of the Royal Opera House, and more recently working far beyond Covent Garden, promoting creativity and cultural partnerships across Britain. She says, "I always thought I'd feel a passionate sense of loss when I stopped dancing. What was absolutely wonderful was, as the volume turned up on the new career, the volume turned down on the old one." So, Deborah Bull, by your own admission, ballet leaves an indelible, profound mark on a professional dancer. I wonder what mark it's left on you.
I think the mark it's left is a strong sense of values, values which are derived from repeatedly working on yourself, on your profession, the sense of discipline, the sense of teamwork, the sense of playing the long game, the sense of learning from failure, and that constant pushing the boundaries forward whilst respecting the past.
I'm afraid to say that I was a little broad brush in the introduction about the name for what it is you do now. So you're going to have to enlighten me.
Well, I joined King's College London after 31 years at the Opera House, so that was a very big leap indeed, where I'm Director of Cultural Partnerships, both to ensure that the thinking that's generated in the college gets out into the sector, so that the research is not just words on a page, but as importantly, if you put artists with academics, they will inspire them to innovate, to take leaps of faith, to see the world differently, because that's what artists do.
You are well known for your articulacy, indeed we've just heard it described. Played there in promoting the arts and helping people to understand why the arts are important. Mm. It was whilst you were still a principal dancer at the Royal Ballet that you found your voice publicly, as it were. You took part in a debate at the Oxford Union. The motion was, this House believes that the National Lottery gives too much money to the elitist arts. What is your recollection of that night when you got up to speak?
I was invited to go down and be on the panel that obviously argued against that notion, and it was a life-changing moment. That act of research in marshalling the arguments was a first, really, marshalling arguments in words, not movement, and then seeing the impact. And I think having that sense, and this goes, you know, right back to my childhood upbringing, that sense of duty. Somebody's got to speak up for the arts. Why would I renege on that responsibility?
And what about being, I mean, I suppose your highly tuned sense of performance and living up to the expectations of an audience stood you in good stead. But being overwhelmed by the surroundings?
It was extraordinary. I was conscious of how difficult it is to describe a world in which you're so embedded. I have this with ballet. You know, people say, what is class? What is the bar? How do you really start? And I had the same experience asking people what it would be like at the Oxford Union, because they couldn't tell me the basic things I needed to know, like what do you wear? What's the architecture of the space? How do people address each other? Because for most people who've been within a university environment, that's a given, that's understood. And so I turned up wearing what I thought was quite a natty outfit of trousers and a jacket and a silk shirt. I thought that was fine. What I didn't know was you wear ball gowns at Oxford in the debate. Yes, it's all black tie and ball gowns. So there was I feeling kind of snazzy. But I was aware that I was carrying a card which nobody else was carrying, which was, I'm a performer. I know the arts aren't elitist, and I can tell you why they matter.
It's time for the music now. And of course, music must have played almost a day-to-day significance in your life, given that you're a dancer. How have you gone about choosing your list?
You're right. I mean, I am one of those privileged people who has been accompanied every day of my life by live music, not just music, live music. I've lived my life to the sound of a full orchestra. It's an exceptional thing, really. But what I've done in choosing the list is focus on those pieces of music which trigger emotions and feelings and memories, because I think, you know, on the island, that's what I'll want to do, is remember those key moments, those key people in my life.
So tell me about the first piece then.
My very first dance memory must have been when I was 8 or 9, and I went to see my sister perform at her grammar school in a concert. I mean, evening of varied pieces. One of the pieces was a dance piece. They danced a piece about the Berlin Wall. And it was my first sense that dance could be something other than fairy tales. It could talk about things that mattered. Moving forwards, I think that moment when the Berlin Wall fell, I think it was the Kennedy's death moment for my generation. We all remember where we were when we heard it. And, of course, this piece of music I've picked is the Beethoven 9th, what's traditionally the Ode to Joy, but in this case the Ode to Freedom, which Bernstein conducted 6 weeks after the wall fell. And I can only imagine what it felt like in Berlin to be shouting, singing freedom across what had been that great divide.
Ode to Freedom from Beethoven's Symphony No. 9, recorded live on the 25th of December 1989, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. So, Deborah Bull, I think it's about 12 years since you last danced professionally. Are you able now to go to the ballet and enjoy it, or are you always sitting there in the red velvet seat with a critical, sharp appraisal of what's going on stage?
I think I've even gone to that point where I watch it and I see them do extraordinary physical things and say, oh, how do they do that? It is quite a long time. It's true also that whenever I see anybody go on point or lift their leg in arabesque, you know, the neurons which drive that movement, they fire in my brain too. So I do know exactly what it feels like.
You literally feel their pain.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, no, not their pain, their achievements.
But you have written very vividly about dancing on stage and actually feeling, you know, the explosion of pain in a calf and trying to overcome it. I mean, I've read the sort of visceral descriptions of trying to sort of tamp down this sensation in order to achieve the next move.
The old cramp in the left calf.
Yes.
I mean, that's the fouettés in Swan Lake when you go up and down on that left leg 32 times. And yes, you're operating often at the limits of endurance. But you have to learn to differentiate that pain between the pain of a serious inflammation. And that's the very tricky thing. You know, the mechanism by which you improve and gain strength is the same mechanism by which you injure yourself. By which I mean, when you micro tear a muscle, it repairs stronger. That's what you do when you go to the gym. Now, if you micro tear a bit more than micro tear, then you're injured. That's a very, very fine line. And dancers can struggle to know which side of the line they are.
I planned to ask you how your feet are, but I noticed that you almost danced in here in a pair of very unforgiving looking kitten heels today. I imagine your feet are fine.
They're not bad. I've got one big toe joint, you know, the sort of the bunion, which I danced when I shouldn't have danced. I was coming back from a bad case of salmonella food poisoning. I was not strong enough and I landed in a crooked way. So that's my one little niggle.
And do you dance for pleasure?
Well, I do now. I mean, I started off dancing for pleasure. That's how it all began. I used to dance around the house, dance around the street. My mother said, look, she's going to be a dancer. That's, I'm sure, where it came from. When I was dancing professionally, I stopped dancing for pleasure. If you're used to having a script It's very hard when people say you'll go ahead and dance without a script. That's the classic dancer's anxiety dream. It's not being in an exam and not knowing the question. No, it's being on stage, the curtain goes up, the music begins, you think, I haven't got a clue what I'm supposed to be doing.
But when you were dancing professionally, would you not get up and have a dance at a party?
No, I would rather have put my hands in the fire. I was so unsure of what I was supposed to be doing and so fearful of being exposed. So I really learnt to dance for pleasure after I stopped dancing professionally.
Tell me about your next piece of music then.
Well, this is a perfect segue into this. So when I was 40, I was invited to go down to Glastonbury for the first time. And all I knew about Glastonbury was perimeter fences, people breaking in and loud and drunkenness and, you know, and worse. And so I was pretty fearful, but I have long thought that fear isn't a good reason not to do things. So I went down with some friends and we arrived very late. And in my head, Orbital were playing. Actually, I've looked back. They weren't. That must have been another year, but that's my memory. And so the next track is one of the tracks which will always make me think of dancing in the open air. Nobody's watching you. They can't see you. It's dark. Nobody cares. They're having a great time. So it's Orbital with their signature piece, really, Chime.
Was Orbital and Chime and memories for you, Deborah Bull, of finding your dancing feet at Glastonbury there. So you were born in Derby to Michael and Doreen. Your dad became a vicar. Your mother had been married for a few years at least and had four children when your father said, I've had the calling. How did that go down?
That's right. I was, I think, 18 months old. I think she was brilliant about it, actually, because she was incredibly supportive. Everything was packed into a car. And down we drove to Rochester, where he went to the Theological College. And then when he'd finished his training, back in the car and up to Tupton in Derbyshire, where he had his first parish.
And before that, your father had been, was he a travelling salesman?
Or? He was. Yeah. He sold televisions. And they were both part of the local church. The local church was at the centre of the community. They were involved in amateur dramatics. That's how they met. And my father spent a lot of time with the vicar, I think. And then the story goes, he was driving around Leeds with his van and went into the cathedral and sat and thought about it and then came out and came home and said, I'd like to train for the priesthood.
So a salesman and amateur dramatics and then on to the priesthood, which is a public role. To what extent do you think you are your parents' child?
Do you know, I once had an odd experience of sitting between Mrs. Putin and Mrs. Bush at a dinner. But I spent most of my time talking to Mrs. Putin and was telling her about my parents. And she said at the end of it, she said, do you know, I think you got the best from your father and the best from your mother, which I took as a huge compliment. So I do think I have elements of both of them. I have my mother's practicality, determination, appetite for hard work, creativity and performance. From my father, you know, I think there is nothing more profound than seeing your dad every week put on a dress and stand up in front of a congregation and say what he believes in.
Yes.
So when people say to me now, how come you're not frightened of talking about the value of the arts? I look back and I say, well, I grew up with it. I grew up with that sense of it's a duty to say what you believe in.
Not very many people can say they've sat at a dinner between Mrs. Bush and Mrs. Putin. What were you doing there?
It's like a Pete and Dud story,
it is.
Isn't it?
Sounds ridiculous.
I had that Brigitte Bardot knocking on my window. So I was at the G8 spouses dinner at Gleneagles.
Ah.
Actually, it was a very extraordinary day. It was the day that the London bombings happened. I sat between Mrs. Bush and Putin. Anish Kapoor and I started a conversation which Mrs. Bush didn't
like. This story
like.
Just gets better and better,
it does. So Anish and I were putting forward the idea that with any crime, you might have to consider there are two victims, that there is the victim of the crime, but you could look at the perpetrator as being a victim of some sort. Well, Mrs. Bush thought that was relativism gone mad and turned away. So hence I spent most of the evening talking to Mrs. Putin through a whispering translator.
Right, just as long as we got that cleared up. Time for some more music then, Deborah Bull. We're on your third.
Well, we were a musical family always, and my most vivid memory is of my father singing Streets of London by Ralph McTell. And in fact, he wrote to Ralph McTell and said, I'm singing your song, do you mind? And he wrote back, said, I know of 220 versions, yours is the 220 verse, not please send me my royalties, which I thought was lovely. But this song, I realise now, was the first time that the bubble of my fairy tale childhood began to open up, that I had a sense that the Streets of London were not paved with gold, as Dick Whittington might have us believe, but actually there is sadness and there is need. And so I look at this song and I see just a sense of me beginning to grow up.
Have you seen the old girl who walks the streets of London? Dirt in her hair and her clothes in rags. She's no time for talking. She just keeps right on walking, carrying her home in two carrier bags. So how can you tell me you're lonely?
That was Ralph McTell in Streets of London. So, Deborah Bull, from playing a smarty in the Kingdom of Sweets for a show at Derbyshire Miners' Holiday Camp to getting into the Royal Ballet School, aged about 12, that's quite a leap.
Do you know, I don't really remember much about it. I remember my ballet teacher, Janice Sutton, saying she should audition for the Royal Ballet School. I thought that was probably what normally happened. Only now do I realise that in all of Janice's time, she sent two students to audition for the Royal Ballet School. 40 or 50 years she's been teaching. So I just had a strong sense this was what I wanted to do. No, stronger than that. This is what I was going to do. I was going to be a ballet dancer, and if there was a logical next step to take, it was to go to the Royal Ballet School.
And your parents were happy to support you in that, were they?
Absolutely. I mean, my mother would love to have been a ballet dancer. I know that. And so I have no doubt that a lot of that rubbed off on me. But they were incredibly supportive. It was, you know, it was challenging and difficult. The Royal Ballet School is a fee-assisted school. So, in fact, the fees are the least of the problems. But when you add on theatre tickets and piano lessons and, you know, me coming home and saying, Mummy, can I? I don't cringe, but I feel sad. I wish I'd understood a little more how hard it was for them. But you know, somehow, this was my mother's pragmatism and creativity. She always found a way. I have no idea how she managed it.
So you arrived there when you were 11, 12. Mm. Enduring puberty can be very difficult for any adolescent girl. But when you are in an environment where the dance aesthetic is super lean and pretty flat-chested, it must have been very difficult.
No, I mean, it was really later on in my career that I struggled with maintaining that necessary physique. The actual going through puberty bit wasn't such a problem. I mean, you go through adolescence there, and that's interesting because, of course, part of the purpose of adolescence is to allow you to take risks, to go off the rails in a safe environment. Within ballet training, it's quite hard to do that because you do need the discipline. You do need to be up every day. You don't want to rebel against your teachers because actually they're the people who can get you where you want to be.
Right. We do need to fit in the music, of course, Deborah. What are we going to hear next?
Next, we're going to hear a piece of Mozart. I fell in love with Mozart, and it's a love affair that's never ended. I could have chosen any number of pieces, but I've chosen the overture from The Marriage of Figaro, and I've chosen this because more latterly at the Opera House, I presented the live big screens. And we always came back to The Marriage of Figaro as the perfect piece of cutting music so that we would use it for the title sequence. So for me, this brings the adrenaline of the live performance. I'm standing there, earpiece in my ear, and at the end of it, there's a Pavlov and his dog's moment when those last bars play out and I hear the producer going, coming to you live, Deborah, 5, 4, 3, 2, go.
Thank you.
Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, played by the Staatskapelle Dresden Orchestra, conducted by Sir Colin Davis. So, Deborah, let's talk for a moment about life in the Corps de Ballet. It's an ensemble role, but I'm imagining that whilst one's in the Corps de Ballet, the need to try to distinguish yourself as being better than and worthy of elevation to the next role must come pretty strong.
You're absolutely right. That is the tension. You have to stay in line. You have to be identical to the next person, arm not higher, arm not lower. At the same time, you are desperate to prove yourself and to stand out and shine. But it's a much more collegiate atmosphere than people think. Of course, sometimes you look and you think, well, why has she got that? I don't understand. I work harder. She misses class all the time. Or I'm really good. Actually, in the end, most of us can see when talent arrives and when talent is deserving.
Right.
So I waited, I think, about 5 years to be promoted to coryphée. It was a really slow burn.
Can you paint a picture for us of being a principal ballerina waiting in the wings? You know your music cue is coming shortly. You're peeling off your leg warmers. You're scuffing your satin point shoes in the resin box. And you feel what?
Everything crowds in on you. You have this sense of the ghosts hovering, the people who've danced the role before, the people that you have to live up to. You have a sense of your own expectations. For many dancers, there's a strong sense of self-doubt comes in. I can't do it. I can't do it. So it's a very profound moment. You have a sense of all of those ambitions, years and years of wanting, months and months of rehearsing, and suddenly the moment is there.
When people arrive at the Royal Opera House and its equivalents around the world, what they're wanting, what they're expecting is perfection. I mean, I sat next to people at the ballet and had them count the amount of pirouettes just to see that the prima ballerina gets it right.
Yeah. But I think, you know, you raise a question about what is perfection.
Yes.
And I think one person's perfection is, yes, she did 32 fouettés with a double at the beginning and a double at the end, tick. And another person's perfection is, well, she fell over in the first entrance, but my goodness, I had never thought about that relationship between Romeo and Juliet. I had never felt loss. So I think people are looking for a different kind of perfection.
Are you able to recall a single performance where you thought, that's it, I captured it?
There was a performance of Don Quixote in Japan where I was yet again stepping in. I was upside down, literally. We had 2 days. I was jet lagged. My partner was sick. We went on, and from somewhere I found the reserves of strength, of self-belief and confidence to do the show. And it was the most extraordinary experience. I went home and I think I wrote, you know, I hugged this unusual bedfellow to myself, this sense. Yeah, I'd nailed it.
It moves you still to think about it.
It does, it does, yeah.
Let's have some music then while we enjoy that. What are we going to hear now?
If I ever had a signature ballet, this was it. It was a piece called Step Text by William Forsythe. I had the luxury of 6 weeks in the rehearsal studio with Bill. And so I felt I carved this ballet into my body. Even now when I hear it, I have a sense of exactly how I'm supposed to be doing it. And it was 13 minutes, barely left the stage, an endurance test. Red leotard, no tights, nothing else. Totally exposed. Wonderful.
Bach's Violin Partita in D minor, Chaconne, performed by Nathan Milstein. So, Deborah Bull, let's talk then about the rigours of maintaining a perfect physique as a principal dancer. It's difficult. It's very difficult.
I think it becomes difficult for a lot of people because there's a lot of emotion wrapped up in that. I was a child, if you like, of what I call the great protein myth, you know, that 70s idea that we should all eat protein and no carbohydrates. And gosh, isn't that back? So what a lot of people do, and it's not just dancers, is reduce their intake of carbohydrates and increase their intake of protein and then try to do exercise. Well, in fact, that's a really inefficient way to fuel activity. That's when injury happens. So in every sense, it's completely mad. And I went wrong a lot of times.
Well, tell me about that then. When it went wrong, how did it go wrong? I mean, did somebody take you to one side and say, you know, you're 3 or 4 pounds too heavy or you're not looking quite right?
It wasn't quite as scientific as that. It was rather brutal. I was in the dressing room and the ballet mistress called across the room, "Deborah, I do think you should stay off the milkshakes." I know. And I look back now and I think, gosh, it was another time. And that did have a big effect. I never suffered from a named eating disorder. I just, like a lot of people, went through cycles where I would try not to eat and then where my body would say, come on, and I'd eat too much. I was very fortunate that I entered a relationship with a physiotherapist, and he was the first person to strip all the emotion away from it and look at it scientifically. And I was able to use my intelligence and my ability to analyse to get over that whole period.
Dame Nanette de Valois was the woman who started the Royal Ballet. And
absolutely,
you were actually, I was going to say, you were lucky enough to be on the end of her attentions. She was still around intermittently when you were dancing. What happened when you encountered her?
She was. And I do feel lucky to have been on the end of her attentions, because it just makes for good stories, really. I mean, she always seemed old, venerable, hugely important influence in British ballet, never mind the Royal Ballet. She didn't like my surname. She had a real problem with my surname. So she would say, Deborah Bull. I must talk to her father about that name.
What about Rudolf Nureyev? Did you at any point, I mean, I'm sure you must have seen him dance, but did you ever encounter him?
Yes, I did. This is a little known, minuscule footnote to dance history. His last performance at the Royal Opera House was in a performance of Romeo and Juliet where he danced Mercutio. And I was Mercutio's harlot. So technically speaking, I was his last ever partner at the Royal Opera House. Now, as I say, it wasn't in the principal role, but it was a huge privilege.
Let's have some more music, Deborah Bull. Tell us what we're going to hear now.
Every year, the Royal Ballet would do a big tour, Japan or America. In 1986, we went to Russia, and I was bitten in Moscow. I don't know by what. I just saw this thing on my leg. I was determined to go to dance at the Kirov. And so I went to the doctor, got painkillers the size of gobstoppers and made the flight, but I couldn't walk. Eventually, I had to give up and say no, and I was flown home. But there was a period when I was existing on these four-hour painkillers, and I would take one at midnight before I went to sleep, and then at 4 o'clock I would wake up in screaming pain. And of course, the painkiller takes 20 minutes to work, so what do you do in that 20 minutes? And I will play this CD of Poulenc, and the second movement in particular has this beautiful soaring melody which would act as a kind of painkiller, and underneath it this throbbing continuum which made me think, it's okay, life goes on.
The Andante con moto from Poulenc's Piano Concerto, played by the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Charles de Troyes, with Pascal Roger on the piano there. So, Deborah Bull, let's talk now about the arts, because that's the world that you are immersed in, and it's the world that you promote and indeed on occasion have to defend. We face considerable spending cuts, as we know, in public services, and the question over public funding of what can reasonably be regarded as elitist arts, given that most people do not experience them. How can it be justified, do you think, spending public money on things like opera and ballet?
I think I have to pick you up on the notion of elitist arts, because I've always felt the arts are practiced by elite artists, but they're not intended for an elite group of people. And I'm particularly interested in how we explore the value of the arts more broadly. So not just within what you might call the closed environment of art centres, but actually across health, across well-being, across communities, across regeneration. We don't live our lives in boxes, but we fund things in boxes. So we say that's the arts budget, that's the health budget, that's the education budget. For me, the arts are profoundly educational. If you explore and engage with the arts, you're necessarily engaging with those big questions of life. You're dealing with questions of loss, of identity, of pride, of nationhood. Everybody has the right to expand beyond their immediate horizons. And I think the arts are hugely important in allowing us to explore all those facets of humanity and to take some choices about how we behave.
When you were creative director of the Royal Opera House, you argued for the importance of mad ideas. What did you mean?
I think it's really important that we take leaps of faith and we take risk. The thing that fascinated me was, what is the impact of success on an organisation's appetite to take risk? Because as you get more and more successful, you have more stakeholders, longer term plans, budgets, etc., etc., your capacity to take risk reduces. Now, if you bring in people to work within your organisation who aren't subject to those constraints, you can create a place where people can experiment, they can collaborate in mad and bold ways and come up with new approaches.
Let's have some music. You're seventh. What are we going to hear?
Well, when I set up ROH2 at the Opera House, I was learning on the job. I had two things stood me in good stead. A clear vision of where I thought we needed to go. Total naivety about the pitfalls. But I knew I needed around me some new voices and some old hands. And I was very fortunate that Phyllida Ritter, who had been working with the organisation, moved across to help set up ROH2. It was an absolute decade of creativity. During that time, 2007, 2008, for the first time I experienced loss. Three women who were central to my life all died. And my mother, Pat Kavanagh, who was my agent, and Phyllida Ritter. And for Phyllida, we organised a little concert at the Opera House to mark her incredible achievement, to remember her. And we commissioned Helen Chadwick to write this piece with words by John Lloyd Davis, who worked in my team. And it's called Unforgotten. And this is for Phyllida, Pat and my mum.
Unforgotten. 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 Where the keen eye watches over the world it made. Unforgotten, unforgotten.
That was Unforgotten, composed by Helen Chadwick. She was also one of the performers, along with Joanna Foster, Barbara Gellhorn and Hazel Holder. So, Deborah Bull, you've never had children, and I'm wondering if you think the level and extraordinary variety of the work you've done would have been different, or indeed even possible, if you'd had to be a mother as well.
It was something I guess I was always clear about. Yes, it was, really. And of course, as I get older and you think, oh, was that the right thing to do? Actually, it was the right thing to do because it was the right thing at the time. It has made me more attached to the family I have. I call them my upwards family because I haven't got a downwards family.
As we know from your introduction to the last piece of music, your mother has died. Your father is still alive. Mm. Your mother was around, though, to see your great success. What have your parents made of your success?
My mum, as I said...
Why are you laughing?
I guess it's asking me to sort of define what I've done as success, which is not the way I look at myself, actually.
Right.
I think that's why I laughed. But my mother, absolutely hugely proud. My dad, interestingly, when my last book came out, The Everyday Dancer, which it's not about me, but of course it's about, you know, the life of being a dancer, he wrote me a lovely letter saying he couldn't put it down. And he said, because I didn't know this about your life. So I suspect I've been quite private and self-contained about the so-called, you know, in inverted commas, success. But I think Dad's proud of what I've achieved, yeah.
Tell me about your final piece.
I had a much too big birthday and on the spur of the moment decided to ask, you know, some friends and family to dinner. I was hoping Dad would do Streets of London, but he won't sing it anymore. However, he chose to sing Forever Young by Bob Dylan. So there's me, much too old. My dad at the time, almost 78, singing Forever Young.
May you always be courageous, stand upright and be strong, and may you stay.
Bob Dylan and Forever Young. So, Deborah, it's time for the books. I give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and one other book can go to the island. What's it going to be?
I would like to take the massive four-volume Encyclopedia of the Human Brain, which is edited by V.S. Ramachandran.
And a luxury, too.
So much of what we did at ROH2 was not recorded because it was all new. But actually, my partner made a film of a piece by Will Tuckett called Pleasure's Progress, which is Will cresting the wave of his genius. It takes the Hogarth stories and brings them to life. If I wanted to weep, I could watch Gin Lane. If I wanted to laugh, I could watch Beer Street. That would be a luxury.
Right, that's your luxury then. And which one disc of the eight would you like to save?
It would have to be The Bark.
Deborah Bull, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.